Good afternoon again, everyone. It's Wednesday, September 4th, and welcome to our third event of the day. Last is best, right? No, not. It's really been a wonderful day. We've talked to Hannah Dennison in England, and then we just talked to Andrew Piper in Toronto. And now here we are in Denver. And where are you, Jim? Are you in Florida or in Connecticut?
In Connecticut right now.
Okay. So, yeah, that's the fun of Zoom, is that you can be with people like from all over in the same afternoon. So we are here to talk about both books, and they are both on display here. Francine's book, Death on Tuppernuck, and Jim's new book over here. And it's called The Red Horse. Sorry, I lost my place. And both of them have autographed their books. So we have signed copies of The Red Horse for sale, and we still have some signed copies of Death on Tuppernuck for sale. And we'll be talking about the books and why you would like to acquire them. So, Jim, this is your 15th Billy Boyle mystery. The first one, Billy Boyle, an imaginative title, was a Dulles Award nominee and one of BookSense's top five mysteries in 2006. In addition, Jim's written a couple of short stories, one in The Usual Santas, which is a wonderful book. Oh, look, we have a copy of, there we do, I'll hold it up. We have a copy of Billy Boyle. Look at that.
Fabulous. Collector's item.
An autographed copy of Billy Boyle.
Collector's item.
Yeah, a real treasure. Thank you, Patrick, for pointing that out. He's written some short stories, and at the moment he has one up that you can buy as a digital book, and it's called, what, The Horse Chestnut Tree?
The Horse Chestnut Tree, yes.
Which is really a lot of fun. So, you know, while you've written novels, you've also made an excursion or two into short fiction. Francine is so protean, it's really hard for me to describe Francine. But as Francine, she writes contemporary mysteries, the Mary Folger series set on Nantucket, which is what Death of Tuppernuck. Death
on Tuppernuck.
I'm sorry. Death on Tuppernuck is about. But as Stephanie Barron, she has also written a number of historical novels, standalones, the most recent of which was That Churchill Woman. And then she's written a long-running series called Being Jane Austen, which may be coming to its inevitable conclusion, because Jane died too early, alas.
Anyway, she did.
She really did. So many of you will know Francine as Stephanie, and some of you will know her as Francine. But anyway, she's a long-time and much-valued friend and associate, and so is Jim. So we're pleased to be able to put them together. So Jim, I found that this book was really in the manner of an English country house mystery. There's a whole Agatha Christie thing set around this hospital, which was a lunatic asylum way back. So one of the things I love about your series is the fact that you're always changing the subgenre and the form. So I think that that's a fascinating, you know, we've done spy stories, we've done regular thrillers, we've done military action, now we have an Agatha Christie book, even done like investigation, almost like police procedurals. So what is it that inspires you to take up a particular structure or form when you begin one of Billy's novels?
Well, I think it's important in a series to modulate the setting and the theme so you don't get too repetitive. And at the same time, what I found is what readers really want is to have the same thing every time, but different. So they've come to get close to the characters. They want to visit with the characters. And then the characters have a certain way of interacting with each other. So they have their own set of demands, but then you have to deliver a different story. And there's a real tension there, I think, between not wanting a series to go too far afield from what you're used to and the reason you've come into it. And wanting to deliver something that current readers will step into and enjoy. So after the last two books, which were set in northern France during the height of the fighting, I thought it was time to pull back a little bit and get back on more peaceful ground and create something that was a little different but would put the characters, the same characters, in the same sort of jeopardy. And it's also important to me to have a story where we see the effects on the protagonist of all the violence that they encounter and inflict. So I also wanted to show what the effects are of the violence in wartime and what that does to people, not just Billy, but all the other people that inhabit this special hospital.
What's interesting about that, Jim, is that to my mind, a lot of the atmosphere of the novel is about the suppression of those effects, mm-hmm. that they are in a place that is nominally treating them, protecting them, but is also really suppressing them.
Yeah.
And there's an unspoken agenda that is really setting the nature of all of their days, which is troubling and compelling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that interested me about this story, and actually it's the most difficult novel to talk about in a setting like this, because so much of what happens would be a spoiler. But suffice it to say, there are secrets that are held in this hospital, secrets that can't get out. And it's a way of looking at how far will a government or a nation go to defend itself? How close will they become to the very enemy they're trying to defeat in order to be victorious? And I think that's the theme of the novel, is how far is too far? And what do you do as an honorable person when you come up against that secret?
Did you know that? Sure, but did you know that was going to be the theme of the novel when you sat down to write it? Was that your agenda when you sat down to write it? Or did that somehow evolve as you wrote Billy and Kaz's story?
And I have to say that a lot of this came from my obsession with the TV series, The Prisoner, the Patrick McGoohan series. Because the fellow who co-produced that series with McGoohan was named George Markstein, which I took as a name for a character in the book. And he wrote a book about a real special operations executive lodge, Inverleer Lodge in Scotland, where spies really were kept on ice, and they called it the cooler. And he wrote a novel about that. And then he took some of that into the Prisoner series. And what that, I just assume everybody knows about this fantastic TV series, but what it explores is the rise of the police state and the notion that the individual doesn't matter, that they have to serve the interests of the state no matter what. And I think I was so enamored of that theme that I took it into this novel. And the secret, the truth that's at the heart of this, when I found out about it, I was so gobsmacked that this really did happen, that I thought, well, this has to be the centerpiece of the story. And that's what the red horse is all about, even though I can't tell you what the red horse
is. Of the title, yeah. Yeah. And so you turn that over in your research that you do on an ongoing basis for the series. How long ago did you know that this was something you wanted to grapple with?
I actually found this this little tidbit years and years ago, and I filed it away. It was in an article about psychological warfare during World War II. Mm-hmm. And I just said, that's going to come back. That I have to do something with that. And then when I read the book, The Cooler, by the real George Markstein, I thought, this is how it can all come into play. And that happens a lot, where I'll find a snippet of information and just store it away, because I know later another piece will come forward and allow me to illuminate that in a way that makes sense for the plot in the book.
Mm-hmm. The research for you must be an ongoing process that pertains to each book you're writing, but also overarchingly to the series. Mm-hmm. Or is it just something that you're passionate about enough that you are constantly reading about World War II?
I'm always searching for that that tidbit that is going to fascinate me. And I thought I was onto something for a future book when I came across a recent biography of Audrey Hepburn. She was very young, but involved with the Dutch resistance to some extent. So I got that book. I thought, this is great. Audrey Hepburn in Holland, in occupied Holland. And I read
book. You know, like 10,000 writers saw that and were like, oh my God, my next book.
But I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find a way into her story that worked for me. I mean, she did hide a British soldier, and she did a lot of things. But I just expected that something would reveal itself, and it just didn't. So too bad, Audrey.
Too bad, Audrey. Oh, please. Yeah. One of the things that I think has helped keep everything interesting and fresh, Jim, is that you have not only changed up the form of the story that you have written, but you have changed the landscape and the cultures book to book. Yeah. So while following a chronology of the war, which, you know, it is such a multifaceted war. Even now we still find out things about the war. I mean, there's a plethora of books all of a sudden about Paris and, you know, women and, you know, various things happening in Paris, but there are just endless stories about World War II in different locations, not even in the Pacific Theater, but in the, you know, although you did make one brilliant foray into the Pacific Theater, which is one of my very favorite of all the Billy Boyle stories.
You got Jack Kennedy, can't go wrong.
Well, it isn't just Jack. I thought, you know, there was so much there that you wrote about that other authors have not brought into their books. But from you, you know, I have been inside the Vatican, you know, I've been to Switzerland, you know, we've been to North Africa, we've been to so many, been to Italy, you know, Norway, where your first book started. We weren't in Norway, but their Norwegian court was in England. And so, you know, you can learn amazing numbers of things about the war that you might not, the ordinary person might not have thought about reading your books. But I think the fact that you keep changing up the background, the landscape, and then the kind of story means that every book is a whole new adventure. Do you feel that way, Francine, when you read them? I know you're a real fan, like me.
I'm a huge fan. Yeah, no, that's what I think is one of the strengths of Jim's writing, is that he is able to give you almost a standalone with every book. And so you can enter the series at any point in many respects, and have an completely contained coherent story, rather than feeling that you are indebted to the series for your understanding of the characters. And every situation is new, every situation is relevant, every situation is compelling in each of the books in the series. And that's one of the great gifts of the Billy Boyle mysteries.
Absolutely true. And I have to tell you, Jim, in all honesty, that when I picked up this marvelous book over here called Billy Boyle, and I read, you know, the introduction, that this was in fact I think it might have said he was a nephew, but he's more of a shirt tail relative of General Eisenhower. It flickered through my mind that this was kind of a cheesy premise, and I didn't know if I was going to like to read this book. And yet it turned out to be, I think, your conception of him as distantly related to Ike, but therefore drawn into things that an ordinary person would not have been involved in, has been brilliant. You know, and also the fact that he was a policeman before he entered into the military and thought he was going to get a cushy berth, or his relatives thought he'd get a cushy berth thanks to his relationship with Eisenhower, where in fact he has been in the thick of danger, possibly even more often because of Eisenhower.
Right. You know, and it also, yeah, it gives.
I was just going to say, it's all worked out, and I often think back to my original thought about, and I'm glad I stuck with it, or I would have missed something really remarkable.
Well, I had those thoughts in the beginning too, but what I saw was the possibility that he has carte blanche from Eisenhower, and anywhere I want to send him, I can just have Ike send him. So it works out that you don't have to strain credulity too much to follow Billy to all these different places. But every now and then, I do get a lot of emails from ex-military people a lot who enjoy the series. But every now and, then, one of them will say, if I ever had a guy like that at my command, you know, he never would have gotten away with all that. And all I can say is, well, Ike's there to back him up. You know, he's going to get away with anything. And those are some fun scenes to write, too, because I'll often imagine that person as a character I need that Billy puts one over on. So, you know, get my revenge one way or the other.
I like that. I
do too. So Francine, as said, it's important to distinguish that you were an analyst with the CIA and not a spy out working in the field. But as a result of that experience, you're probably a much tougher critic and reader of the Billy Boyle series than I would be.
Not at all, because because the wonderful gift of World War II is that it predates the CIA and formal intelligence service in the United States. So in writing about anything that has remotely to touch on OSS operations or, God help us, the British SOE, you have a lot of latitude if you're me, because I'm not going to judge anything from that period. I think the SOE obviously was so much more established, and there's so much more archival stuff that you can access.
And they got rid of a lot of the archives from the SOE and the OSS, as I understand it. There are some, but...
Well, the OSS docs are being released, so... I mean, they have started being released in the past 2 years. So there's a wealth of information coming out, and that's about time limitation. But yeah, I mean, it all depends on what you can access, because the CIA's Center for Historical Studies exists, and they publish a lot of stuff internally. And, you know, whether you can access that through FOIA or not, I don't know, but I think the OSS records are being released, and you know, even the SOE, you know, that you've probably delved far more into it than I have. But to me, you know, you don't criticize anything about World War II, because a lot of it was seat of the pan, seems to me, and field operational, and you know, you can go a long way with that as a fiction writer. Yep.
So before we go back to the Red Horse, let me digress here, because Francine wrote a book that I think is absolutely brilliant called Jack 1939, one of my totally favorite books ever. And I find it interesting that each of you has written a book about a young Jack Kennedy. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the Billy Boyle that is about Jack. What is it?
The White Ghost.
The White Ghost. Okay. So you wrote about him in his role as a PT-109,
yeah.
Right, in the South Pacific. And you, Francine, wrote about JFK before the war. I mean, obviously from 1939.
As a junior in college.
Right, and explored to the degree that you could his medical background, because, you know, I thought that was a fascinating part of the book, was him trying to deal with whatever health challenges he had, which swamped him really all of his life.
Right.
What kind of research, I meant to ask you this and I keep forgetting, what kind of research did you do to try to portray Jack dealing with his physical disabilities?
There is stuff in the JFK Library Archives, but it's pretty minimal. And then there is one excellent biography, and I'm so sorry, this has been so many years ago that I'm gonna blank on the author's name, but it's the only one that has, and it's only in the first 50 pages, some reference to his medical files. Some of it's anecdotal, you know, like in the archives, there's the fact that he, at age 2, was the first time he was given the last rites of the Catholic Church. At 17, he was diagnosed incorrectly with leukemia and sent to a hospital in New Haven from Choate. And he was there for 6 to 8 weeks, during which time the headmaster's wife would write to Rose saying, I go to see Jack every other day. We play records, we play cards, I read to him. The whole school prays for him every day. He would so love to see you. And then in the files, there's a letter from Rose Kennedy's secretary in Palm Beach saying to the headmaster's wife, it is not convenient for Mrs. Kennedy to leave Palm Beach at this time. And that suddenly gives you this amazing context that he's one of the most privileged young men in America during the Depression, because he's at Choate in 1933. And at the same time, his mother doesn't come see him when he's been diagnosed with leukemia, which at the time was a death sentence. It's a bizarre sort of mosaic of comments and letters that you kind of can piece together. One of my favorite things about the early stuff in the JFK library is the Harvard file, because you can get from his school records everything he was reading each year, his advisor's comments, his grades. His senior thesis is there with the advisors who read it, the comments of those folks who actually read it and graded it. All of that stuff is immensely rich, I think. And, you know, there's been a wealth of biographies. There's a wonderful, I think, a wonderful opportunity for both Jim and me as fans of this kind of stuff in a book that's coming out this month on JFK that is the first comprehensive sort of look, not the first, the second comprehensive sort of look at his early life. And I'm going to be snapping that up because I really want to see what comes out of it. But yeah.
Anyway. Well, for readers, I really recommend, if you're at all interested, that you read Francine's book first, because it comes chronologically first. And then you read Jim, who has got him, you know, as an active warrior in the South Pacific. And the contrast is fascinating. I'm not so much engaged with JFK as I am. What? Sorry.
If I would also really, really recommend, if you're interested in Jim's book, The White Ghost, and you read it, reading John Hersey's 1944 account in The New Yorker, which you can access archivally, of sitting down with Jack and getting the first account of PT-109 that was to a reporter in the United States. The original reporting went through, interestingly, Richard Nixon, as Jim brings out, who was posted in Southeast Asia, and also the Supreme Court Justice Byron White, who knew Jack and was a naval intelligence officer in the Pacific, and is the first person who sent home news of Jack being found when he was finally rescued. And interestingly, Byron White was a character in my book because he traveled with Jack in the summer of 1939. He had shown up in Europe to take up his Rhodes Scholarship. And at the time, if you were a US ambassador, you had all the Rhodes Scholars from the US stay at the embassy. And so Jack got to know Byron White, who was a football hero in collegiate America. And to me, it's always fascinating, that sort of 6 degrees of separation, that, you know, Richard Nixon and Jack are both in the Pacific, that Byron White, who Jack would later appoint as his Supreme Court Justice, is the one who sends home the intelligence that he has been found with his crew, minus two people. That sort of intimacy of the war is lost so much in the enormous landscape of the war, and yet it existed. And those are those moments that as a writer you grasp onto, because they're like, oh my God, here's the human element of this story. It's fascinating. Similarly, John Hersey. So John Hersey wrote, of course, Hiroshima, which was the first account of the actual impacts of the atomic bomb on Japan for The New Yorker in 1946. It was an incredibly powerful work because most people in the United States had no notion of the truly horrific impact of the atomic bomb. But he also knew Jack Kennedy personally and had written PT-109 as a story because Jack Kennedy had proposed to John Hersey's wife in 1939. Frances Ann Cannon, John Hersey's first wife. Jack Kennedy wanted to marry her in 1939 in February. of 39 proposed to her, and she turned him down because he was Irish Catholic and he was Joe Kennedy's son, and she was a canon of North Carolina, the Towel Magnet family, and you did not marry an Irish Catholic gangster's son. So she married John Hersey, interestingly, and Jack went to their wedding, and then later John Hersey sat down with him in New York and got the full account of PT 109. I personally, as a writer, love those human network connections, mm-hmm. and you sort of, I mean, I just found all of that by doing research. You start putting the pieces together and nobody has laid it out for you, but that's the gift of research. You stumble on this stuff. So Jim, I would love you to talk about that. How did you stumble on some of this stuff in The Red Horse?
Well, part of it was, let me just go back to Jack Kennedy for a second, because we can't get away from him. When you were talking about his upbringing, I saw echoes of that in the period that I was writing about, because he went to the other side of the world, I think, to not only do what he saw as his duty, but to find his place. And there was a scene after PT 109, and he's got a new boat. He's recovered. He's got a new boat. And some of the surviving crewmen go to find him, and they're mad at him, because he hasn't asked them to be on his crew.
They volunteer.
Yeah, and they volunteer and he accepts them, but he turns away and he cries, because he never probably had that kind of close camaraderie and growing up in that family.
Right.
Your mother letting you, be alone in your, what could have been your deathbed. I think that was a large part of the formation of his character.
I absolutely agree.
There's so much to mine from that life that there could be a lot more novels. But
I mean, anyway, similarly, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, a similar point is that he was disqualified for service.
Right, yeah.
In 45. I mean, excuse me, in 1940.
Yeah. He tried to get in the army, and they...
Right, his brother was taken by the Air Force, or the Army Air Corps, and went to learn to fly in England. And he was medically disqualified. And so he spent 5 months finding a doctor. Well, he started at Stanford in a business degree, quit that, and then found a doctor who would pass him medically with no questions asked.
And he got permission from the Navy Department to have a prep doctor.
Right. Basically, he fudged the whole thing just to go. And so, yeah, you're right.
I've lost track of the question.
So sorry. The question was...
I lost track of the book we're talking about.
Yeah. Let's go back to The Red Horse. So, Jim, enough with Jack. Okay. So, in The Red Horse, Jim, what were some of the nuggets that you stumbled on in your research that you absolutely had no knowledge of and had to use in that book that just suddenly presented themselves to you?
Well, one piece was related to heart surgery. And one thing I had not known was that it was absolutely forbidden without any basis, scientific basis, for doctors to touch the human heart. There was a doctor in the 1920s in England who performed heart surgery and was banished because of it. He lost his rights at the hospital. Even though the operation was a success, the patient died of other causes, and the whole medical community was up in arms because you just didn't touch the human heart. And a doctor named Dwight Harkin, an American doctor, was assigned to the Mediterranean Theater of Operations, and he decided that he was going to try to not so much do open heart surgery, but extract shrapnel from the blood vessels going through the heart. Mm-hmm. He was thrown out of the Mediterranean because the Army Medical Service wouldn't allow that. And this is where we get back into people's history and how they came to be the person they are. This fellow, Dwight Harkin, grew up on in Iowa, I think. His father was a country doctor. When he was a kid, he used to go on rounds with his doctor and carry his bag. He grew up always wanting to be a doctor. When he finally got his medical degree, his father expected him to come back to Iowa and join him. But Harkin wanted to go farther. He wanted to work on the East Coast. And his father just about disowned him. He finally got his father to come out and watch him operate. And his father walked out. He said, "You're going to kill that man." Walked out of the operating room. So now that piece isn't in the book, but that's what fascinates me in doing this research, is when you find what's the driver for this person to do what they did and get where they got to. And I believe for Dwight Harkin, it was because of his father's rejection.
Yeah.
You know? I don't want to get back to Jack again, but you know.
Right. Let's go there.
Well, let's drag it into the Red Horse and say that Billy's friend, because there is an ensemble cast. Mm-hmm. It isn't just Billy. And Billy's Polish baron friend, Kaz, has been suffering from heart failure because he had rheumatic fever, if I remember this right. Yeah. And so in this book, it's a real crisis. They're in this hospital in England. We should talk about how Billy got there. Billy, it's a very modern story. Billy is there because he had a serious overdose of drugs in When Hell Struck 12, in the book that precedes this, which was The Liberation of Paris. So basically he exits that book, you know, in a, what is it, meth or morphine? I can't remember.
Methamphetamine.
Right. So he's had a huge overdose of methamphetamine. His life is in danger. They take him to this hospital. And Kaz
has had a heart attack in Paris. Yep.
So we have to worry about both of them. Is Billy going to throw off the drugs? And, you know, will he be able to function? And for Kaz, you know, you have to really worry, because there is no open heart surgery or whatever at that point. Is Kaz going to just finally die from this ailment? I thought it was a very scary book to read in that respect.
You know, I think the scariest part for Billy was the prospect that they would no longer be a team, because it wasn't that Kaz was going to die right away. But back then, if you had mitral stenosis, there was no cure, and it was bed rest for the rest of your life. So Kaz looked like he might have to leave the service. And of course, then he wouldn't be able to go on the search for his sister in Poland. So there was a possible breakup there of the team. And I think that was as traumatic for the characters as anything else.
Oh, it's very traumatic for the reader.
Yeah.
With no spoilers, we won't talk about that. So, you know, it's been brought up in other books. I wish I could remember one, which I thought it was particularly fabulous. But a big question is, you know, what happens if you have a spy or an intelligent agent who, for one reason or another, becomes a serious security risk? And the book I'm thinking of, which was a paperback original, the father had, for years, had a cover as a washing machine salesman, and he develops dementia or Alzheimer's, whichever one it is. And his son, in going to cope with him, suddenly has to realize that his father wasn't actually preparing or selling washing machines. His father was a spy. But now the agency, probably the CIA, wants to kill his father because he's such a security risk. And so the son is now trying to protect the father from extermination by his employers. Mm-hmm. And that's a great premise. But in fact, what do you do when you have somebody who, if they spill, you know, could do an enormous amount of damage? Francine, you've written 3 books about various espionage agents and so forth out doing things. But you know,
I was going to say, I see why that was a paperback original.
Yeah, but at the same time, the dilemma. Oh,
I mean, I find the trope of, you know, the trope of, you know, the CIA silencing someone who's a security risk just kind of hilarious, because it's so extreme. It's akin to the, no, it is. It's akin to the, you know, oh, that you never really leave. I've had people say that to me. You know, they never let you leave, do they? And you're like, yeah, you know, they totally let me leave.
Here I am.
27 years. Believe me, they let you leave. So, you know, it's just, it's part of that. To me, it's akin to the whole conspiracy theory world where anything is possible, anything is credible. And as a fiction writer, I think you owe it to your readers to actually hew to what is credible, because fiction is fiction anyway. And so if you want to have that sort of sense of credibility with the reader, that what you are telling them is factually based, you know, you don't exaggerate it to the point of craziness. I think what Jim was doing was totally different in The Red Horse, because he was talking about something that was during an active theater of war. And so much of what these folks were doing was immediate. And, you know, unlike the guy who's retired and suddenly has dementia.
Well, there is a bit of a parallel to that story in this book. There's the relatively true story of an English professor who helped develop a lot of the odd weapons that Churchill loved to support. And he had a nervous breakdown and could not stop talking about his projects. And he knew it, but he just had such a case of nervous exhaustion that he just had almost like Tourette's syndrome. And they had to put him away in this.
You have a character like that.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a character like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Some of these characters, the mutes, I'm really interested in the mutes. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit? Have this whole idea that there are patients who cannot speak, right. Psychologically they cannot speak, mm-hmm. because they are terrified of saying too much. So it's the opposite problem that we've just been describing of someone who's a security risk because they talk. These are patients who are incapable of speaking because they have put such a firm clamp on their conscience and mind that they will not reveal anything, even though they're home, they're not in interrogation cells.
Right. Yeah, these are the mutes in this book are agents who have made their way back, but had suffered so much under the Gestapo interrogation and had held out that not speaking, just they could not stop it. And that was the price that they paid for what they went through. And I thought it was interesting to have, I should say this hospital is both a medical facility for injuries and wounds and also a mental institution. So there's two wings, a north wing and the south wing. And the mutes are part of the landscape of the north wing where they just literally suffer in silence.
How did you find that phenomenon? Where did you come up with the mutes?
You know, I think I extrapolated one case and made it a little more general, but there was mm-hmm. a case of an SOE agent who came back and actually what I found out is there were a lot of jailbreaks and escapes from the Gestapo. There's any number of stories about agents literally jumping out of windows when they realize that they've been left unguarded for a second, or the French resistance ambushing a bus full of prisoners going from one Gestapo headquarters to another. So a lot of them who went through torture did get out. Mm-hmm. And that's where those stories come from.
Great.
So something else that you pull through to gain continuity in the series is Billy has had a love interest, Lady Diana Seton, for a long time. And as you mentioned, Kaz recently has discovered that he may have a surviving sister. And so in this book, because of events that took place earlier, the fate of those two women is in the background and all, and continuing to add tension to the story. But you also have a whole thing about Sweden, which, you know, you pull through from the last book, but you don't resolve in this book. So I like the fact that, you know, there's this unknown thing traveling along through the book that you leave up in the air at the end of it, which I hope propels us into the next book, which I'm imagining might actually take place some of it in Sweden, since after all, you gave Norway a turn, so it's only fair.
Well, actually, not right away. The next book, which I'm just finishing up now, is set in the Soviet Union.
Oh.
That came about because it was at a crime fake writers festival in Florida with Reed Frail Coleman, and he was sort of pressuring me, why don't you write a book and put it in Russia? That'll be fun. And I said, no, I don't know how to do that. But it was one of those things that just stuck with me. I said, okay, I've got to find out a way to get Billy to Russia. So that's where the bulk of the next book is set. So I've been practicing up on my Russian cursing and all sorts of interesting things.
Yep, and you might, oh Lord, I'm trying to remember my Russian. I did some a while ago. I think my line will be, I need you on your pen, you mind. Which means I don't remember anything. So, but actually it sort of makes geographical sense because if he's now in England with the Red Horse, and one thing we can be reasonably sure about is that Billy at least will survive the Red Horse and move on. So Russia's the next step and Sweden is, you know, right up there.
Not that far.
Years ago, when my husband and I did a wonderful cruise around the Baltic, it was dizzying because, you know, you would pivot from Sweden where the enemy would be Russia, and then you would go to Finland where the enemy would be Sweden over here and Russia over there, and then you would go to Russia and the major, you know, was Sweden. And we don't, we're so Eurocentric rather than Baltic centric. I think we often don't think about these rivalries, this intense 16th century rivalry between Sweden and Russia and so forth, or the fact that much of Russia was actually settled by the Norsemen coming down the rivers. So, you know, it makes perfectly good sense to me that you would go to the Soviet Union before you go to Sweden. Yeah. Yay. So let me ask Patrick if we have any questions over here. Not so far? Oh, okay. Everybody's just enthralled listening to you. Right. So
ask any question about Jack Kennedy.
No, we're not going back to Jack. Let's talk a moment about Death on Tuckernuck and Mary Folger. Jim, you said you had a couple of questions you wanted to ask Francine.
Well, yes. I was just in awe of the weather scenes and the hurricane. I literally had to look out the window to make sure that the rain wasn't pouring down when I was reading it. So what I want to know is, have you been through a hurricane? I mean, you live out west, so... what's been your experience with hurricanes?
I grew up on the East Coast, and okay. Three of my sisters live on Cape Cod, okay. And my whole life I've gone to Nantucket. So yeah, hurricanes are something that I'm intimately familiar with, I would say.
Was that a fictional hurricane based on any recent hurricane?
It's based on basically Hurricane Bob.
Okay.
Which was... I want to say fall of 1991. It also eventually turned into the perfect storm, mm-hmm. Hurricane Bob, yep. Because the weather pattern went up to Nova Scotia, reformulated and came back. And the perfect storm is not called a hurricane and it is not named. But it was almost like a round two of that. Okay. And so if you're at all familiar with it, you know, it's the impact of it, it's a nor'easter that, so you know nor'easters because you're a New Englander and how they come in off the Atlantic. And so it was a hurricane that met a nor'easter and it turned into this incredible thing. So I was kind of looking at wanting to use Tuckernuck, which I should say is an island, 900 acres, square acres, off the western end of Nantucket, that is essentially a closed community owned by the people who are the property owners on the island. And I have always been fascinated by Tuckernuck, which most Nantucketers are, because unless you own property or are invited by someone who owns property on Tuckernuck, you do not set foot on Tuckernuck, and there's no access to it in a public transportation sense. There are no services on the island, so no electricity, no fire, no water. There's just individual houses that have propane tanks and their own wells and are totally self-sufficient, and it's not a winterized island anymore, although in the 19th century it was. So I was looking at this bit of land and was told that by the Coast Guard that they can't land there in moments of crisis, that if you are in crisis, if you have a heart attack on Tuckernuck, you have to rely on the people who take care of you to get you off the island to the hospital on Nantucket. And by the people who take care of you, I am referring to a group of people on Nantucket who are known as caretakers, and their profession is to provide everything that people on Tucker Nook need. And that includes solar panels to run their generators, I-beams to build additions to the houses, rose bushes, red wine, trash removal, because there's no trash facility on Tucker Nook. Everything has to be sent through Nantucket. And in the case of a hurricane, it's the caretakers who evacuate you, because they are the ones with the boats who get you off. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, what if there was this major crisis in a hurricane where a boat runs aground because Tucker Nook is surrounded by shoals that shift constantly and are really uncharted. And so you only know the shoals off Tucker Nook if you run a boat into it every day. So what if a boat runs aground as a hurricane is starting on Tuck? And there's a crime scene on that boat. How do you respond to that when the crime scene is gonna probably be blown off its grounding in the hurricane? And what if the murderer escaped the crime scene boat and is on Tucker Nook? And so I loved playing with those dynamics. And of course, the storm is another character in the story. It has to be, because it's a timed event. You know, it has phases with the eye passing over. It has all of the buildup for both Nantucket and Tucker Nook and the aftermath. And I loved the periodicity of the storm setting the agenda of the novel. Mm-hmm.
Well, it really worked. I mean, the storm was a major character in that book. Mm-hmm.
So we should mention that Mary Folger is the chief of police on Nantucket. So basically,
no, she's not.
No, she's not. You're right. Sorry. Well, I had a momentary slip. She's a policewoman working
on detective.
A detective. Thank you. A detective working on Nantucket. Right. And therefore, this is what, the fifth or sixth Mary Folger?
It's the sixth. Okay. And it's really, you know, it's an interesting mesh, as I think you're leading up to, between the public safety role of police to organize a community around a pending natural disaster and have to enforce the sort of legislative covenants that have been established around crisis. And when you evacuate and how you evacuate and where you evacuate to, and, you know, fighting, as we see with masking right now, you know, fighting people's independence and desire to be freed regardless of the danger to themselves. And so she's in that role in the hurricane on Nantucket, but she's also dealing with a crime scene, murder scene in a grounded yacht off of Tucker Nook. And of course you can't get to Tucker Nook in a hurricane. Even the Coast Guard cannot get there. And she ends up flying in on a Coast Guard helicopter as the storm is approaching to rappel off the helicopter skid down to the boat and investigate the boat in the bare minimal time that she has before the storm hits. And so she's juggling those two personas of police, law enforcement and public safety, which I think is, you know, an interesting nexus. You don't often get the public safety aspect of police in a crime novel, but the situation dictates that both are simultaneous in this instance.
Absolutely true. And yet that isn't where I was going, strangely enough. Where I was going was that because Mary Folger is a detective, that the previous books are what we might call procedurals, but, you know, they're investigations. But Death on Tucker Nook really is a thriller in many respects. And that comes back to what I was going to say, what I said earlier about Jim, is one reason his books are so interesting is because, you know, one might be a spy story and one might be a thriller and one might be, as we said, a country house murder. And I thought Death on Tucker Nook really was, had the dynamics of a thriller, even though you are exploring those two things, which makes it different than everything I know about Cranberry Bogs I have learned from reading Francine and and Mary Folgers. The other aspect about their books is they're incredibly educational, but you just take it in while you're having such a good time reading them, and then you learn all these wonderful things. So I think all readers of crime fiction have like a complete grab bag of unrelated and often totally useless but fascinating facts that they've acquired.
Great trivia players, yeah.
Yep. Patrick, you're looking as though you might have something you want to offer there.
Well, actually, I have a question for Jim. Mark says, how did you end up in the front row of Woodstock, Jim?
There was a question from out of the blue.
Well, so all sorts of things go on my Facebook page. But Mark, wherever you are, I worked for a newspaper when I was in college. It was the Meriden Journal. There used to be these things called afternoon newspapers. And I was the fill-in guy in the summer when everybody's on vacation. If you needed a sports story or human interest, I just covered all the different beats. And we got a press release about this festival, and I tried to talk the paper to sending me, and they were not interested. So I just took their stationery, rode away for a press pass, got my press pass, and ended up in the press pit at Woodstock. And I'm in the movie, I'm down in the corner of the screen, about this big, in a few spots, so.
Sounds like something Billy Boyle would do.
I love it. My husband refused an invitation to go to Woodstock, and I'm not sure he's ever quite forgiven himself. It comes up often. So Jim, we know that you are heading out to the Soviet Union with Billy, and then perhaps or perhaps not to Sweden. Francine, you do so many different things. What is your current project on the boil? Is this going to be the Jane Austen book, or are you writing another Mary Folger, or are you doing something totally different?
I am finishing up a Jane Austen novel called Jane and the Year Without a Summer. It is the 14th Jane Austen novel set in 1816. The Year Without a Summer, of course, was the aftermath of a volcanic eruption in 1815 in Indonesia. And it caused a dust cloud that went around the world for the subsequent year and caused famine throughout Europe and the United States. It is the summer that Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein by the fire with Shelley and Byron because the weather was so horrific, nobody went outside. And none of the crops grew and there was no summer. So that happens to be the last summer Jane really had, although she did live until July of 1817. But it is the first moment in which she seems to acknowledge her illness, and she goes in May, late May, early June of 1816 to Cheltenham Spa to try and drink the waters and cure herself. And so this book is set in Cheltenham.
Well, so pleased you're writing it, because I know you had some hesitation about, you know, writing
This isn't her dying. I said to you, I didn't want to write the book in which she dies. No. Or I didn't know if I could write the book in which she dies, which is 1817 in Winchester. So we'll see. But this was a nice midpoint between.
Yeah. Well, you've done such an amazing job with them. And, you know, I know all series can't go on forever and that people don't go on forever, but it's hard to leave them. So it'll be very hard, Jim. At some point, you know, you're going to have to do like every last week of 1945 or every week or something if you don't want Billy to. Because it's a whole different thing when the war is over. A book absolutely fabulously described by Joseph Cannon in Istanbul Passage. I think it's one of the truly great books about, you know, when it's over, now what? And what do we do with our lives that have been on hold and interrupted for, you know, so long? Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you ever want to do that book for Billy, or whether you can just sort of drag your heels as we move along. Because we're in 1944, right, at this point?
Right, there's still a lot of...
Well, a long way to go. And you'll probably not go back to the Pacific Theater. Do you think that was Billy's one foray?
I think so. I nothing has occurred to me as a reason to go. I'm excited about the book I'll be starting on soon, which is going to involve Billy with the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, which was a unit made up of Japanese Americans Nisai's, whose families were all in internment camps in America. And what fascinated me about them is they fought in southern Italy and southern France, mostly under the command of a white officer who really didn't think much of them, and used them and sort of ground them up in combat. So I think there's going to be a lot of interesting dynamics to come in that story.
Well, this has been a very heartening discussion then, since I can look forward to wonderful books from both of you. Thank you so much for spending time with us this afternoon. It's always a pleasure to see you both. I'd rather you were here, but I'm so glad we could do it this way. And maybe the three of us can rendezvous in Scottsdale at the same time next year.
Next year.
Right, next year. Or maybe we could just all go to the Biltmore and hang out and record it in one of the rooms.
That's my vote.
Yep, that would work out well. Anyway,
around the fire pit.
Yes, with a drink, right. Yeah. But do you know that they have taken out the whole beautiful interior garden and made it a swimming pool?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's completely different. Dana and I were struck dumb when we went. So you may have to rethink the Biltmore. But that's for another day. Thank you all very much for joining us this afternoon. It's really been a pleasure to visit with James R. Benn and Francine Matthews. Enjoy the rest of your evening. Good night.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.